Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. Where are we off to?
Well, I've been driving into town for the last few weeks, and I keep seeing this big banner hanging over the street that says Global Volunteer Month. And so that has been on my mind. That's clearly the thing that's in the forefront of my mind, because I can't help but seeing the sign. And also, volunteerism is very, very near and dear to my heart. I do a lot of it, and I talk a lot about the importance of volunteering in my classes. And so that's kind of the overriding theme of today's show. But I want to start with a side topic or a side road to this topic of the importance of volunteering, but something that's come up in class a couple times over the last few quarters. And it's this, and it's not just this few quarters, it's always. And it's one of the most common questions that I get asked as a therapist is, how do I deal with getting too involved with my clients? Or I'm nervous about going into this profession because I'm going to get so connected to people that I'll be so sad, or I won't be able to, you know, go home and not think about them and worry about them. Or, you know, this work feels like it's going to be really emotionally draining. And how do I do that? That's a very common concern, and rightfully so, for anyone going into the helping professions, no matter what that looks like, whether it's caregiving or social work or therapy or counseling, any of those professions that call on us to be of service to others or to help others has a possibility of being emotionally draining. Because when you put your heart into anything, you get invested. You get vested in that person. You get vested in their life. You get vested in the outcomes. So it's been really important to me the last few quarters to kind of try to change the narrative with my students about what it is that we're doing when we go into the helping professions, or what it is to be a clinician. Because in order to stay in any helping profession for a long time, the average burnout rate for social workers is 18 months. They don't last a long time in the profession unless they do a lot of work to prepare themselves for the potential emotional drain. Therapists have a longer shelf life. I don't know, that sounds kind of odd. They have a longer time in the practice because most therapists will do their internship hours, and then once they get licensed, they tend to not stay in the really heavily taxing world of psychotherapy or therapy with people with very high needs. So what I've come to realize over the course of my career is that the way I do my work as a clinician is different than the volunteer work I do outside of my profession. That when I am working, I, yes, am of service to another person. I am giving of myself. I am wanting the best for them and getting invested in some ways in their outcomes. But it's my job. It's not my volunteer work. It's what I'm being paid to do. And it might not make sense right away, but there is a clear delineation between those things. That when I'm going to work and sitting with someone and hearing their story and sharing, you know, some of the deepest, darkest times in someone's life, and hearing these stories of trauma quite often that are really painful, I'm able to sit with that because I know very clearly that all human beings, if given enough time and space and support, can come to their own conclusions. They can find ways to move forward in their lives. It's resilience. And all human beings are capable of resilience. Some people are born with natural resilience. They're able to bounce back up. And that's the definition of resilience, the ability to bounce back after some sort of challenge or trauma or loss. And some people naturally are able to get back to their lives, however their life has changed. Some people have to learn and develop those skills of resilience. But it is capable. We are all capable of that. And so what I've come to learn about my profession is that my job is to reflect what I'm hearing, not to absorb what I'm hearing. It's not my job to take in and carry the burden of the people that I'm working with. It's not my job to take from them their pain or to lighten their load. That isn't my job, and that would be a disservice to myself, but it would also be a disservice to my clients, because when we feel like we're going to rush in and save someone or fix someone or take away their pain, we're taking away the opportunities they have for developing grit, which we talked about a few weeks ago, also developing and growing their resilience and their ability to trust themselves and know that no matter how awful the circumstances, we all are capable of finding our way through. And it's in those times that we find our way through the darkest, most difficult experiences that we grow stronger and that we develop more confidence and that we know we are able to carry on. It took me a while to get there. I definitely didn't have that confidence in everyone having the skills when I was first working as a therapist. And also, I think many people are drawn to the helping professions because there is this desire to fix someone or save someone or rush in and make the difference. It feels good to be the person that, you know, pulls someone back from the edge. There's a lot of ego involved in that. And I get that. But in order to have stayed in this practice in this world for almost 30 years, that had to pivot fairly early on in my work, because again, I couldn't have continued doing this work if I were taking on the sadness and the burdens and the traumas of every person that I ever worked with. I can be empathic to that, but to take responsibility for them would be career ruining. It would also be emotionally devastating because we can't carry other people's losses. So imagine when I bring that up in my classes, the students are always flustered. They don't understand how I can say that when I'm doing my work as a clinician, it's my job and I'm there and I'm focused and I'm providing that service to my clients, but that's not my volunteer work. That's not where I'm giving service to others freely of myself. I'm being paid for that work. So on the other hand, if I want to deeply invest myself in something, if I want to feel like my heart is there and my soul is into it and I want the best for it, that's where service comes in. That's where volunteer work comes in. Then we're choosing where to put our heart and our time and our energy and expecting really nothing back but the satisfaction of being a part of something bigger than ourselves, of the satisfaction of seeing an organization or cause that we care about be successful or not, but being involved with other people who also have a heart for something similar to you. And so being a part of that community of people who care about a cause or care about an organization is really uplifting and empowering and filling of your whole being. That's what fills my heart, is all of those volunteer activities that I do. And just simple volunteering for things that happen in your life. A neighbor in need, a friend who needs a shoulder to cry on. You know, a friend who needs a shoulder to cry on is much different than someone who's paying you to come in and listen to their story. It's two different things. You listen differently, you respond differently. And so when I'm working as a volunteer or sitting with a friend in need or holding someone's hand outside of that, that's a different role that I am in than when I'm doing my work with others. And I think the struggle that my students have with this, and I'll be curious to hear what you think about this as well, my students struggle because they feel like they want to do meaningful work, and they equate that meaningful work with almost self-sacrifice, that if I'm sacrificing myself in some way, you know, just bleeding for the well-being of my clients, then that means that I've really done something that matters in the world. But that's not healthy. And it's not effective. And in some ways, as I said before, it's not in the best interest of your clients. It's not in the best interest of those people that you're working with if you are trying to be their savior or lift them up or fix them. Teachers, when they're doing their work, helping their students get an education, if they're to rush in and always help them with, you know, getting their work done or correcting things for them or making their, you know, life as a student easier, then they're taking away that student's capacity to develop resilience and to develop self-confidence and self-esteem. You know, there's that hard work pays off piece that's really important in teaching. And again, as a teacher, if you've got 35 students in your classroom, they all have stories that could really pull on your heartstrings, but that would not be fair, one, to the other students, and two, to the student that you're working with, because none of us really want to be seen as victims. None of us really want to be as approached as needing help in order to survive. And so in many ways, the best gift we can give to people, whether we're clinicians, therapists, teachers, and even parents, is to model for them, to give them, through this kind of energetic hug, the beliefs that you know they're capable. Being able to show someone, or can't think of the word I want to use, but to show, model, create a space where when someone is with you, your energy and belief in them is so palpable that they feel it as well. That's powerful. That's what the work of helping is. My confidence in someone else that they're going to be okay helps them start to believe that they're going to be okay. And that's at the heart of the helping profession. But today I want to talk about the other part, the service part. Not my work, not my job, but the part where I just get to do good because it feels good to be a part of something that needs help. And it is Global Volunteer Month. Next week is National Volunteer Appreciation Week, which is part of the Global Volunteer Month. And so I would love to open up the phone lines today and find out where you volunteer and why. Where is it you put your heart time and your volunteer time? And if you'd like to talk about that delineation, my thoughts, between the work that we do when we're getting paid, our professional work, and the work we do as volunteers, do you agree? Is there a separation? Should there be a separation? How do we train young professionals to be comfortable in that role as a professional, not feel like they have to be responsible and save every person? So we'll be opening up the phone lines today. Our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can reach me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast our show wherever it is you get your podcasts. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You'll find our podcast, subscribe, leave a review so other people can find us, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and open up those phone lines and get your thoughts on volunteerism here during Global Volunteer Month. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
If you ever find yourself stuck in the middle of the sea, I'll sail the world to find you. If you ever find yourself lost in the dark and you can't see, I'll be the light to guide you. Find out what we're made of when we are called to help our friends in need. You can count on me like one, two, three, I'll be there. And I know when I need it, I can count on you. Like 4, 3, 2, and you'll be there. Cause that's what friends are supposed to do, oh yeah.
Ooh. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And our number is 805-781-3875. And the topic on the table today is Global Volunteer Month, the importance of volunteering and all of the ways that it benefits our mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those we care for and responsible for, which would be all of our fellow citizens, part of our pact, our compact, as a democracy, is that we are all responsible for the collective well-being of those people that we share community with. And volunteering is at the essence and the heart of how we keep our democratic society together, stepping in and finding common ground in ways that we can share our time. So this whole idea of volunteering and mental health really aligns well with the five tenets of mental wellness. There's four. I always slip in a fifth, but there's four core tenets of mental wellness. The first one is meaningful work. And when we talk about meaningful work and mental health, you know, our definition of meaningful work is going to be different for every person. Some people find deep meaning in cooking. Some might find it in being an accountant. Some might find that deep meaningful work in, you know, working in a store in some way. All of us have to find what that work is that makes us feel satisfied, whether it's because we're able to provide an income for our family or care for ourselves, whether it's because this meaningful work stimulates our intellect and makes us feel competent, or this meaningful work is something that is helpful and meaningful to others in impacting their lives. We all have to find, that's part of our tenet of wellness, is to find that meaningful work. And it doesn't really mean that we do the same work our entire lives. Some people do, but fewer and fewer people start off on one track of meaningful work and then continue on with that for the rest of their lives. But that search for that sense of meaningful work is a really important sense of mental wellness, which is important to point out because since the pandemic, we've had a real shift in how we view and think about work. The term quiet quitting, kind of moving away from the intensity of work or not feeling as invested. A lot of the working from home has maybe improved the quality of day-to-day lives relationally. But that sense of feeling productive or belonging to an organization or feeling like you're part of a crew or a team, that's really been impacted by how we're shifting work. You know, and meaningful work also doesn't mean that it has to be 80 to 100 hours a week. But that sense of being productive and having something to get up for is really important to our wellness. The second tenet of mental wellness is deep, satisfying relationships, which is challenging in a society that has so many opportunities for us to talk to so many different people, whether it's through social media or all the, you know, different places that we go and the traveling that people do. To have that core group of deep, satisfying relationships, it's actually a much smaller number than most people would think it is. Research shows that we can maintain between 15 and 50, which is a huge difference, but 15 and 50 deep, satisfying relationships. And that's maybe not all at once, but over a course of a lifetime. So maybe when you're younger, you've only gained those 15 deep, satisfying relationships. By the time you're, you know, my age or you're in your 80s, you've had time to develop and really create 50 deep, satisfying relationships with others. But the definition of a deep, satisfying relationship is someone that you can be with unfiltered. And think about that. In your life, how many people can you truly be with unfiltered? Because I'm definitely not at 50. I might be at 5, if I'm thinking and I'm honest. Like, the people that you can be unfiltered with and know that you're accepted and know that you're loved and know that you're safe and cared for and not judged. That's a tall order for someone to be able to meet all of that criteria. And I don't know how many people I am that person to as well, that they feel like they can come to me completely unfiltered, that I won't be judgy and, you know, be able to hold that space for them. So when you think about your deep, satisfying relationship, you'll have a lot of acquaintances, right? We can maintain a lot of acquaintances that you can be friendly with when you see them in public or at community events, and you genuinely care for them and want nice things for them. And maybe you send Christmas cards. I send out about 100 Christmas cards, maybe 110. And I've tried to make that list smaller over the years, but that's about. So I would say in my, you know, the larger circle of people I've known in my lifetime, there's there. Then there's the acquaintance people. And in the acquaintance people, there's a lot of people who think they know me in certain ways. So that's the acquaintances. But then we get down into the friends, the friend groups, and we have all different kinds of friends. You know, we have friends we just like hanging out with, but we don't really talk about serious things with. Then we have friends that are just really, you know, fun to do certain things with, but you wouldn't go and do other things. You have friends that you don't really go out with, but you tell each other all your secrets. So we have different levels of friendships. But then we're coming down into that, like, more deep, inner circle, the real close ties. And it might not even be your family. You might be, you know, more often than not, we filter ourselves around our parents, maybe our siblings, because we have a lot of history with each other. We don't want to, you know, say something that upsets them because our family has expectations of who we are and how we're going to behave. So now when you're getting down to the center of those deep, satisfying relationships, the place where you can lay your soul bare can be really small. And those relationships are really important to nurture and care for because they are so rare. And quite often, it can be more challenging in those deep, satisfying relationships because we do lay ourselves bare, and we might be hearing hard truths about ourselves or having tough conversations, the one that makes life worth living because we get into the nitty-gritty, like getting down to the bones of something. I love those conversations so much. But there's very few people you can really go there with. So that's number two. You know, think about your deep, satisfying relationship world. Are you working on them? If you're spending, you know, 4 to 5 hours scrolling your social media, you do not have time to nurture those deep, satisfying relationships. Then it would be my hope that your most interpersonal, right, your most intimate of relationships would be someone in that deep, satisfying relationship circle. And I think I've mentioned before that when it comes to what is considered a soulmate marriage, which we'll do a whole show on that because it's a very 90s thing. But in those relationships that are considered like your first and foremost intimate partner, 20 hours a week is what it's considered to take to maintain a full intimacy with another person. 20 hours a week. And that's not sitting next to each other on the couch, scrolling your phone or doing Wordle. That's actually engaged with them in some way, you know, whether it's talking or making food together or going for a walk or playing a game or having a conversation or doing something that stimulates that relationship. And then the other intimate things that make those relationships so powerful. I could spend a long time on number two, the deep, satisfying relationships. But we'll go to number three, which is service to others, which is kind of the goal for today or the topic of today. Service to others is number three on the tenets of mental wellness. And again, it's separate from meaningful work and it's separate from deep, satisfying relationships. It is that which we do for the benefit of the collective wellness of our communities. And it also serves us as individuals. It helps to lower blood pressure. It helps to improve our physical wellness. It helps to improve our mental health, as we're talking about. It helps us to build a network, a support, a community of people that we can lean on in times of need, because we aren't, we shouldn't be acting as lone entities in the world, that we should have networks and communities of people that we can lean on when we need help, and we're there for them when they need help as well. That service to others piece can be anything from volunteering for an organization. Maybe that's one organization that you put in quite a few hours for. Maybe you'd like to do the one-time volunteering where you go do the coastal cleanup, or you volunteer at an event, you know, at a theater, or you're helping with organizing an activity for youth. Some people like to spread out their volunteer work. Currently, one of four Americans regularly volunteer. One of four. One in four. Interestingly, two out of three Americans do help their neighbor in some kind throughout the year. Maybe not the same neighbor every day, maybe it is, but two out of three Americans at some point in it throughout the year will help a neighbor. The most likely age group to volunteer are those 35 to 54, the most likely to volunteer, which is interesting because that tends to be some of the busiest times of our life when you're raising children and you have a full-time job. But this age group of people tend to find also the time to volunteer, probably because they're coaching their kids' sports or helping with school activities or organizing, you know, fundraisers. So that makes sense that that group is doing a lot of volunteer work. Interestingly, San Jose, California is the number one place in the United States for recruiting volunteers who are of the millennial age. And millennials actually have a fairly high rate of volunteering. About 30% of all millennials find time to volunteer in their lives. when it comes to employment too, the benefits of volunteering kind of cross over to our job search. 60% of hiring managers view someone who's volunteered or our work as a volunteer as a valuable asset when hiring. They're looking for that in people's resume. And those who spend time volunteering, 27%, they have a 27% better chance of gaining employment because they spent time volunteering than if they were to do nothing at all. volunteering overall by generation, the largest group of volunteers are the boomers. 30% of the population, boomers, 24% of the silent generation, who I'd imagine be quite old at this time. So the fact that even 24% of the silent generation are volunteering is amazing. About 30% of the millennials, and then 20% of Gen Z, which is the now high school and college age, young people, 20%. So also, and I don't know how these statistics work out because I'm taking them all from our 2021 census and some from Pew Research and some from a volunteer information. But they say that only 4% of college graduates, 25 and older, volunteer regularly each year, which doesn't really fall into the other stats, but I thought that was interesting. And 66% of those people who volunteer say that they volunteer so they can help to improve their community. And then 83% of those who volunteer do so because they support a cause that they care deeply about. They want to be of help in that way. And then overall, 96% of volunteers who responded said that the service they do enriched the quality and purpose of their life, their sense of quality and purpose of their life. And this idea of volunteerism clearly isn't new. Aristotle once said, not that I was there, but Aristotle once said, the essence of life is to serve others and do good. Ralph Waldo Emerson also said that the purpose of life is not to be happy, but is to be of service to others, to do good, to have made a difference in someone else's life. So we've clearly been talking about and thinking about volunteerism and being of service of others for generations. So I guess I'm curious to know what kind of volunteering people are doing. What is it that matters to you? What is it that you care about? Our number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We're talking about volunteering and what that looks like. What do you do to help out? So my intern, Gabe, is here today.
Hello.
Gabe just graduated from Cal Poly. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I had him show me the letter that he received to prove that he actually graduated. Now he's nervous.
No, I'm not.
That's common, though. I still look and see if my license is valuable, is valid. So you're a volunteer kind of person. I mean, you do this as a volunteer with me.
Absolutely. Community service and volunteering started at a young age. It was always involved in schooling. To graduate high school, we had to have over 400 community service hours. But also, I think just being in the agricultural community, you always help your neighbors, and doing good service to others is, I guess, really been in my mind and blood ever since I can remember. Mm-hmm. So I guess I could say I am part of the 83% or whatever that certain number was, because being a part of something that fulfills others' needs mm-hmm. makes me feel 10 times better. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think I'll always do. Mm-hmm. So it's just a part of my life. It's weird if I meet people that don't volunteer, haven't done community service. I think it's, I don't know, I think you should really do it. I think it's important to do it. So,
and you're also, I mean, the first one to jump in and say, I can come do that, I can come help. I mean, that is in your nature and your temperament. But are there organizations that you have volunteered for that are important to you?
I did a Habitat for Humanity. It's building houses for low-income families mm-hmm. For a very long time, actually. Carpentry stuff, things like that, plumbing. So I got to dip my feet in things like that. So, but that's probably the main one. But other than that is just helping other farmers out. Like, hey, can you come give me a hand? I know I don't need to get paid. You know, I know you're busy with work. I'm free after work. You know, I'm young. I got a lot of energy. I'd be more than happy to give you guys a hand.
There is a difference, isn't there, in the work that we do, as I started the show talking about, the work that we do to be paid mm-hmm. and the work that we do because it just feels good to be of help. And if you were to get paid for that work that you're just doing because it feels good, it would in some way, I think, take away from it.
Absolutely. I've gotten handed cash after long days of work, and I say, you know what, just keep that in your pocket. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, kind of thing. And just the bond and relationships that old guys to young kids have is something that I cherish and I really want forever, and really want to be that old guy one day to the younger kids or to the younger youth, because I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I think it's really important, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that you know, my work that I do, it's a helping profession, but I'm not doing it as a volunteer service. And I think when we see our work as being something that's so important that I would do it for free, that's how we undervalue and underpay teachers and therapists and caregivers, because there is this attitude that it's such a meaningful thing to do that you can get paid less because you don't need the money,
right?
Because you're filling your heart so much. And that's another one of the reasons why I say to my students, you need to separate the work you do for pay as a profession and the work you do as a volunteer that you do for free because it feels good. But the two should not be the same, because then you're going to be stuck always being underpaid and undervalued. And therapists have a really hard time charging people for their services because it doesn't feel tangible quite often. And so they end up volunteering their skill set quite often. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're talking about volunteering during Global Volunteer Month. I really want to know, where did you volunteer and why? I'm curious to know. And if you have an organization that's looking for volunteers, I'd love to hear from you as well. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and take your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
When I was younger, so much younger than today, never needed anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find I've changed my mind and opened up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being around. Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please, please help me?
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. We are celebrating Global Volunteer Month, and I'd love to hear about volunteers out in our community. What is it you choose to do with your volunteer time? And if you have an organization looking for volunteers, let us know. 805-781-3875. Susie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you do for your volunteer work?
I volunteer as a tutor for the San Luis Obispo County Literacy for Life program.
How did you get involved with that?
Well, I heard about it on KCBX and said, wow, that sounds great. And there was a training for a couple, 3 weekends in a bank in downtown San Luis. And so I signed up and I went to the training, and it's the most rewarding volunteer work that I have done. I started right before the pandemic, so there was a huge gap between then and my current situation, but I still have the same students.
Wow. And so what is that? How does the organization match tutors and students?
It's mostly word of mouth. You know, someone finds out that there's a tutor, or I have a neighbor, for example, that knew loosely some of my students, and I said, oh, you ought to go. Oh, I would love to go. My son thinks it would be a great idea. And so she started about a month ago, and it was just word of mouth, and we found a tutor. Tutors are not all retired teachers. I'm a retired high school teacher, but a lot of times it's, you know, people from all walks of life, and normally it's one-on-one. But I found a woman who didn't want to come without her husband, And then after the pandemic, she invited her identical twin sister, and she didn't want to come without her husband. So we have two women who tutor four people, and we have a great time together.
And why? What does it do for you? How you said it's the most meaningful volunteer work. What makes this different?
Well, I'm so inspired by our learners mm-hmm. because they work so hard every day, and they come after work, sometimes before they've been able to even eat their dinner, mm-hmm. and come to school to learn. I don't know. It's just I feel like what I'm doing is so little compared to what they're doing to learn to read, write, and speak English. They are all people who are just about through raising their families, and I think they feel a real strong connection to be able to communicate well with what will be the next generation, their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Who
mm-hmm.
will probably speak more English mm-hmm. than their native language. Mm-hmm. So that's a very strong family connection. It's extremely satisfying to reach across cultures and join. And I'm not explaining it very well. But
no, I think you are. And also, I mean, the satisfaction in kind of giving this gift of literacy to someone or be able to help them find it. I can imagine how satisfying it is because, as you mentioned, you're changing their relationship with generations to come in their own family, changing their ability to have relationships with each other.
Yes, and it isn't all Spanish-speaking people in the program. One woman who's been in the longest tutors are Ukrainian, and sometimes we have Chinese students who sometimes it's someone who's finished high school and wants to go into a nursing program and needs just better English skills in order to, you know, do that at Cuesta College. There's a wide variety of people, all the way from, you know, older teenagers to people who might be in their 60s, you know, wanting to learn. So just about every town in San Luis Obispo County has a learning center, and it's just I just can't sing the praises of the program enough because it's just so satisfying to work with people that have chosen to come here for a better life, and they're working so hard to make their lives better every day.
Well said, Susie. Thank you so much. What a great representative of Literacy for Life. Thank you for taking the time to call.
Okay.
Have
thanks.
A good day.
Bye.
So that's just one of many incredible programs and ways to share. And interesting because Susie is a retired high school teacher. And so there's the piece of her professional life that she was paid to do this work, but then to be able to choose to volunteer and give of her time, like it's a whole different sense of volunteering and what that looks like. So, all right, Donna and Brad, since everyone's kind of sitting there hanging around, we're talking about volunteering. And I imagine, you know, the volunteer efforts here at KCBX do not go unrecognized. So I'm curious to know where your volunteer interests are and why you do it.
Well, I will tell you this.
Okay.
I'm a member of the paid staff here, but I also do volunteer for KCBX. And I've done it since I got here. My Thursday night radio show that I do across the tracks, I do that as a volunteer. And I do that because I love the art of radio, and I love mm-hmm. being able to bring that to people. And and the feedback that I get is very encouraging from the people that I do it with. I've also done a lot of volunteering with Woods Humane Society. I hosted a fundraiser for them for 7 years called the Firecracker Boogie, where we brought together local music. And we helped build a cattery there and did some other things. And we're in talks now. It's been a few years since we've done it, but we're actually in talks to bring something similar mm-hmm. back to the area. But for KCBX, I do my thing playing music, and then anything else I can help out, Live Oak Music Festival, if they need me, they know I'm there to come in and help them out. And I find that to be really a gratifying way to spend my time and give back to the community.
Yeah. And it is, you know, a lot of the research shows, and the people who volunteer know this, that there's such a great sense of wellness that we get. It improves our mental health. It lowers blood pressure. It gives us a sense of belonging to our community. And, you know, it's been difficult since the pandemic because 11% of nonprofits closed down during the pandemic because they're unable to keep moving forward. And those nonprofit organizations were able to kind of keep it together have really struggled to, retain or actually regain the level of volunteerism that they had before. So if you thought about volunteering and been a little hesitant to get back out into the world during Global Volunteer Month, it's a great time to reach out. And again, if you're a nonprofit or an organization that is looking for volunteers, this is a great time to share your story. Our number is 805-781-3875. And if you are a volunteer, I'd love to know where it is you do volunteer and why. Why does that matter to you? All right, so we have kind of a group of producers here today in the studio with Brad. So I know, Donna, you do volunteer work.
I do. And all of my volunteer work is animal related.
And why is that?
Oh, because animals are my passion.
Okay.
And I'm willing to do it anytime, anywhere for free. And so my volunteer work lately has been helping to place cats, horses, or dogs into forever homes, because oftentimes people are considering owner surrender. Mm-hmm. And that's something that if I can assist them in some way to go from their home to a forever home, it's so much easier on the pet for them to do that instead of the pet ending up in the shelter. Mm-hmm. So that's my volunteer work that I really like.
How do you find a forever home for a horse? Like, I understand the cat and dog part, but it's not, right? That's a very particular person that's going to.
Yes. Well, that's been my profession. So I definitely have a horse network.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I just put the word out to friends and other trainers and boarding facilities and collectively, because it does take a village, mm-hmm. collectively, we try to make that happen.
And it's interesting, just as Susie is a retired teacher and then volunteers her time doing literacy, you have a profession in the equine world that you paid for, but then your heart then as a volunteer is in doing this other work.
Exactly. Well, I think it fits because I know the horses well and the people well. Mm-hmm. And so when you've spent years in a profession, you develop that community and that network that makes the volunteer aspect mm-hmm. easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have found that a lot of the volunteer work I've been drawn to over the years was through doing things with my kids, and then being really vested in what the programs were, like Destination Imagination and Camp Natoma that I talk about quite often, and things. My kids are, you know, grown and gone, but I still feel very invested in having these things in the community continue on and wanting to see them flourish.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that deep sense. Thank you, Donna. All right, we got one more person sitting there. Is it Elena? You already introduced the show today, so it's just one more moment on the mic.
Hi, yeah. Sorry.
So are you a Gen Z?
Yeah.
Okay. So the Gen Zs don't have a high rate of volunteerism. Gabe thinks there's a high rate of volunteers in Gen Z. What is your experience?
I'm kind of a sporadic volunteer. I will do like events or things through Questa. Mm-hmm. I feel like because I have a lot of other hats that I'm wearing with interning and things like that, I don't make it a priority, mm-hmm. but I try to help out with events. I just did like a volunteer for Questa to film the sports game. So it is kind of what I like to do with journalism, but it's a volunteer. I didn't get paid for it, and it was like 8 hours. So that counts.
There is that kind of, as I mentioned before, that danger of when we love something so much, people can take advantage of us and expect everything to volunteer. So you have to watch your boundaries with that, I'm sure, as well. But how does it feel for you when you do have the time to volunteer? And
it's nice because I try to find things that I enjoy, like filming was something that I actually wanted to watch happen and got to be a part of. So I look at it more as like an opportunity, maybe selfishly for me, but it also does benefit other people, so it feels good.
I know it is interesting. People who volunteer a lot will often say, don't give me big praise for volunteering because it fills me in really deep ways. It's satisfying to feel like you've been a part of something. So, yeah. Well, and I would hope, too, as we get older and we are involved in more things or have more time to be able to volunteer, that third piece of the tenets of mental wellness, to find that service to others, something that you're committed to. Thank you. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. And we started the show talking about the importance of Global Volunteer Month. Next week is National Volunteer Appreciation Week. So if you are an organization that leans on volunteers, it's a good time to give them some credit and show your appreciation for the efforts that they put into helping your organization succeed. So when I was talking about the tenets of mental wellness, as I mentioned, the first one is meaningful work. The second is the deep, satisfying relationships. The third is service to others or for others, being of service. The fourth one is good health, which is another interesting part of the mental health tenets of wellness, because there's part of the good health piece that you can't control. Like our time on the planet, I often think that we all have an expiration date and that the best we can do is kind of improve the quality of our life while we have the time. I don't know how much full extending we can do. But there's a piece of that we don't have control over. But the mental wellness piece of the things we can control are interesting because there's a lot of research about gut health and this connection between gut and mind and mental health. And we're going to see over the next few years, because UCLA and Harvard and Stanford are spending a lot of time and a lot of money in exploring how the foods we eat impact our mental health. And it'd be really interesting because people, you know, talk about if we eat too much sugar, then kids get really hyper. You know, we can already see those connections. Or if we drink coffee, it kind of amps us up. Or there's some comforty foods. People eat comfort food, and it'll make them feel more relaxed. Or so, I mean, there's evidence just in our anecdotal experiences that there's that gut-mind connection. But wouldn't it be fascinating if we were able to turn the whole mental health profession on its side by prescribing foods?
Yeah.
My fear, though, is that the foods that get prescribed will not be the foods I enjoy eating, but they'll find out that they have some like amazing quality in settling the autonomic nervous system.
I can comment on that. I'm a hunter.
Thank you.
So when I go out and harvest an animal, and I feel way more different eating that food than the food that I buy.
And why is that?
Maybe because it's not processed. I mean, we have steers, and my brother's a butcher, and he's done that a few times, and I've hunted hogs, deer, elk, ducks, and when we go out and hunt these animals and we put them in our freezer, I don't know the scientific facts behind them, but my body feels way more healthier. My mind is. I feel way more sharper than the processed foods that I eat.
Well, I would hope also, I mean, that in the process, I like to just say harvesting animals and then hunting, but never killing. But anyway, the whole process.
I'm just trying to be careful.
I appreciate it. But in the process, right, there is that piece of like thanking the animal and. Right,
absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I take that very serious. Mm-hmm. It's a ceremonial piece to every hunter that I hope they follow. You're sacrificing that animal to put food on not only your plate but your family's, and it's a really good feeling when we go out and harvest an animal or hunt down an animal and it feeds my whole family's stomach or belly. And I mean, they feel nourished, happier, healthier, and we went out and did that work. And I think that's also part of a mental health thing.
Absolutely. Well, and it's goes along with the adage, you know, that the road to our heart is through our belly. And it's, you know, a proverb or a wives' tale or whatever, but it's actually very true. And again, this gut mind research that's being done is kind of probably prove out these old adages that people have followed for years, that there is an incredible connection between food that we make for others and the love that goes into making that food. And you're talking about like the love of bringing home an animal, the love that goes into this. I love these people. I'm making this dish, that energetic kind of connection to the food. And then when people eat that, it's not just the food, it's the love energy that goes into it that is more beneficial for the people that are eating it. And it's interesting because I'd read a study years ago about the unintended consequences of the microwave oven being introduced. And the idea behind the microwave oven is that it was going to give people more time in their life. You know, it would free primarily women up so that they could have more leisure time. But of course, the introduction of the microwave oven did nothing to give people more time. It actually just gave them more time to work or, you know, spend now on their phones. Right. You know, people weren't using that extra time to not have to prepare meals, being more connected. And so what this article, this research showed was, ironically, what the microwave oven did was take away a very important piece of bonding and connecting that families had, which was that family meal and the love and attention and energy that goes into making that family meal. And this whole idea that recapturing that time that it takes to make a recipe and share that recipe with your children, your grandchildren, that oral history, and also around food. I mean, food's at the center of every gathering that's of importance, whether it's weddings or graduations or celebrations. And so it's interesting to me that we have in many ways minimized the sacredness of the actual preparation and the eating of the food.
So I think it truly just devalues the hard sacrifice that, you know, the hunter or the male goes out, gathers that animal, harvests females, whoever, and their significant other or partner is back home preparing the recipe, getting the dinner ready, and sets a really good example of good mental well-being surrounded by a good family meal and what it means to feel malnourished and happy and healthy with a good
well-nourished
with a good meal on the table.
No, I agree. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. I really thought I'd hear more from some of the organizations that have volunteers that they are in need of or want to talk about their volunteer organization, but we still have a few minutes. Again, 805-781-3875. But I really like looking at these tenets of mental wellness, again, because people go into therapy because they're feeling distressed or overwhelmed or they're grieving or they're confused or they're anxious, whatever the thing is that draw people into therapy. And one of the first things that therapists really should be doing is looking at those core tenets. What is your work look like? Because people go into deep depressions when they've been fired from a job or lost a job or, you know, don't feel like what they're doing is of value or they feel just, you know, used. And so checking in, what is your work like? What does that mean to you? And then secondly, start talking about their relationships. Do you have deep, satisfying relationships? Do you have one other person that you can fully be yourself with? You know, that you don't have to have 100. You really just need one or two people that have your back that fully get you. So that second question should be that. And then the third one is, what are you doing to feel of service to the community? It's part, again, of our social contract as a democracy, and that it is at the foundation of feeling like we are rooted in connection with our with other people. And then go into the fourth question to ask people, how is your health? How is your health overall? How are you feeding yourself? What kind of movement are you doing? You know, I love this assessment that rewords exercise away from what do you do for exercise to what do you do to celebrate what your body can do instead of punishing you for what you ate. And so kind of looking at exercise and then looking at the time we spend sleeping and then communicating with others, you know, those really seem like the most important questions that should be asked every time someone goes into therapy. 805-781-3875. Hello, Gretchen. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
I just wanted to put in a word for a wonderful program that our local chapter of the League of Women Voters has going.
Okay.
Registering high school students to vote. Kids who will be of voting age by the time the election comes around. So we go out to high schools. The League is a nonpartisan organization, but I have to say, it's one of those volunteer activities that gives back more than you give. It's just really a great kind of thing to engage with the students, answer their questions, We've gone to all the local high schools in the spring, and we'll go back again in the fall. We went to San Luis, Mission Prep, Pacific Beach Continuation High School, and Grizzly Academy. And I just found the students full of questions, engaged about the process, and it gives me some hope because I was feeling a little discouraged mm-hmm. about our current political scene, and I wasn't feeling that excited about writing postcards. So anyway.
I love that because it must be satisfying to see the energy and enthusiasm of the generation coming up. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I look forward to going to work because uh-huh. being around these young people mm-hmm. who are excited about their future gives me hope for the right. future as well. Oh,
it's
thank you.
Their world, and I really feel that it's our duty
yes.
to help them, you know, take hold. So anyway.
Absolutely. So the League of Women Voters.
Great. League of Women Voters, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure people can find it online, I would hope.
Oh, yes, online. And vote411.org, I believe, is their their site on issues. I can't say enough good about them in terms of their dedication
Wonderful.
To the rights of voting.
Thank you. Thank you, Gretchen, for taking the time to call. And I'm glad you're
sure.
getting a great deal of satisfaction of helping the next generation take on their civic responsibility. Have a great
yeah.
day.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I was glad we got a couple calls there. I was glad to hear some feedback about volunteerism. Remember that it is Global Volunteer Month, a great time to step out and get involved if you haven't already. Also encourage you to head out to Laguna Lake this weekend to check out Earth Day and all the activities there. I'm sure they're still looking for volunteers. And one of my other hearts is with Operation Surf, who has a big event coming up next week as well, who also may be looking for volunteers. So there are a lot of ways to engage. But as always, I appreciate you tuning in and supporting this show and the nonprofit work of KCBX. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.org. Find us on Instagram and Facebook. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, and you can podcast. Thank you for tuning in and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
When you're down. Don't you worry, no, don't you fret. The Lord has never failed you yet. So hold on,
hold on.
Help is on the way.
Help is on the way.
Hold on,
hold on.
God is on his way.
Help is on the way.
Hey, hold on,
hold on.
He's on his way.
Help is on the way.
He told me to hold. Changing hand. Yeah, weeping may, yes, endure for just a night, but joy will come.